Coming up on Fronteras, immigration reform could make things easier for undocumented immigrants. But what about people here on high-tech visas?
If I don't find a job, I am possibly looking at going back. I would have to leave.
How an immigration bill could affect immigrant scientists and engineers. Also, the Senate's immigration reform proposal offers a fast track to citizenship for agricultural workers. That's good news for dairy farmers like this one.
My livelihood totally and completely depends on these people doing all this work. My retirement, everything, would pretty much go out the window.
What immigration reform means for dairy producers and their workers and the economy as a whole. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. We know what lawmakers and CEOs think about high-skilled immigrants. They want more of them. Tech companies have been lobbying hard to get more visas for these workers, and Washington has been listening. But what do the high-skilled immigrants want? KPBS science and technology reporter David Wagner found they have very different ideas about how to fix the system.
Every year, on April Fool's Day, American tech companies are off to the races. That's when they can start applying for H-1B visas, which give foreign workers with advanced degrees and specialty skills the right to work here in the U.S. This was a bad year to be a latecomer. In just 5 days, the number of applications shot past the number of available visas. As a result, visas won't necessarily go to the most qualified candidates. They'll go to whoever's name gets pulled in a random lottery. Nathan Fletcher is a senior director at Qualcomm, a major employer of H-1B workers in San Diego. And he thinks the system is getting to be a bit absurd.
You have a group of students who are American-educated students, often just a few miles away at UCSD, that have the skills and the talents we're looking for. But they can get a visa to study and learn, and the taxpayers can subsidize their education, but they can't get a visa to stay and work.
But how can we fix a program for high-skilled immigrant workers that isn't, well, working? The Senate's proposed plan would multiply the number of H-1B visas handed out over the coming years. Aside from a few other tweaks, they basically want to take the program already in place and expand it. But to hear it from the immigrants who've actually gone through this system, that solution misses the mark.
I think increasing the cap's not going to help.
That's Sandeep Chandra, an Indian national who's been living in the U.S. for the last 13 years. Sandeep and his wife, Pallavi Adyantaya, are both here on H-1B visas. He works at the San Diego Supercomputer Center, and she works at Qualcomm. They worry that lawmakers won't address the main problem they and so many others in their position face. They haven't been able to get green cards. Even though Sandeep and Pallavi plan to settle down here, their future in the U.S. is uncertain. There's a possibility that the project Sandeep is working on could end next year.
If I don't find a job, I am possibly looking at going back. I would have to leave. You put in 13, 15 years, and you are still faced with that situation.
H-1B visas allow workers to stay in the U.S. only on the condition that they keep their jobs. And if they seek out new work, they often have to forfeit their spot in line for a green card. Pallavi says some employers are exploiting these restrictions on worker mobility. She sees certain companies paying foreign workers lower wages.
They do get to leverage that aspect as well, not just tie you in, but also tie you in at that wage, because they know you're not going anywhere.
Ironically, Pallavi's point echoes those made by critics of the very program that allows her to work here. These visas are supposed to plug a skills gap. Companies like Facebook and Microsoft say American schools simply aren't graduating enough citizens in high-tech fields, so they need to import workers from overseas. But economists at the Economic Policy Institute and consultants from the Boston Consulting Group say these companies are greatly exaggerating that skills gap, if it even exists at all. They accuse employers of favoring foreign workers because they can't quit and because they'll work for a lot less than citizens. Sandeep and Pallavi have an idea that might address the concerns of such critics as well as the tech companies.
People who come here and get a master's degree, they shouldn't have to probably go through a visa process. They should just go through an immigration process and figure out a way to get them green cards.
If we increase the number of green cards for high-skilled immigrants instead of the number of H-1B visas, employers would still have a lot more applicants to choose from, and the immigrants themselves wouldn't have to put up with unfair treatment.
We're doing everything right. We're going the legal route. The least we want at the end of the day is just a level playing field with everyone else.
But these suggestions might get drowned out in Washington. With 11 million undocumented immigrants possibly getting a path to citizenship, things could get tense. Sandeep and Pallavi say they're not hopeful that reform will put them any closer to their green cards. In San Diego, I'm David Wagner.
Around 25,000 Native Americans in New Mexico will become eligible for Medicaid when the Affordable Care Act goes into effect next year. The change translates to more money for the Indian Health Service. But as Tristan Atone reports from KUNM in Albuquerque, Medicaid expansion will also force Native health providers to deal with something they've never faced before, competition from non-tribal health programs.
New Mexico has one of the largest Native American populations in the nation, and nearly 40% of that population currently lacks health insurance. Take John Armijo, for instance. He's an enrolled member of the Pueblo of Jemez, located in central New Mexico, and when he learned he would be eligible for Medicaid in 2014, he says it came as a relief.
I was thinking, oh God, this would be great for me, one of the baby boomers, and my fellow tribal members. It would be a great thing, and if that happens, I won't have to wait for the retirement age to have these services.
Armijo is 3 years shy of being eligible for Medicare, works part-time for the U.S. Forest Service, which doesn't provide him with insurance, and makes just enough money to be ineligible for Medicaid. However, next year, when the state expands its Medicaid program, Armijo will have coverage and choices.
If my health deteriorates or goes bad, then I'll be looking for other services, you know, like special doctors or special hospitals or whatever.
Like many Native Americans, Armijo has received medical care through the Indian Health Service, or IHS, for most of his life. The IHS system provides free basic services to tribal citizens and pays for more complicated procedures it can't handle at other facilities, if there's enough money to pay for it. According to Jay Steiner with the National Council on Urban Indian Health, current federal funding for IHS is estimated to be at about one quarter of need.
So because of the underfunding of the Indian Health Service, there isn't the capacity to provide a lot of the services that our patients require.
Think of IHS's finances like a pie, or a quarter of a pie if we keep in mind the service is funded at 25% of need. Now take that pie slice and divide it between 612 hospitals, health centers, and clinics across the nation. In states where Medicaid expansion is happening, like New Mexico and Arizona, more Native Americans will have access to that federal health insurance plan. That means when they show up at an IHS facility, IHS can bill Medicaid for services instead of paying out of pocket.
What we're hoping is that we can take advantage of additional revenues made available by the expansion of Medicaid to make up for that shortfall somewhat.
But with insurance comes choice. Once a tribal citizen has Medicaid dollars in hand, they can take their business wherever they want.
We realize that as people get insurance, they have more choices.
Linda Stone is the CEO of First Nations Community Health Source, an urban Indian clinic in Albuquerque.
And that for us could mean that some of our patients will seek care elsewhere, and likewise some patients will come and seek care here.
In rural areas of the state, the challenge of competition may not be as fierce, as hospitals and health centers are often few and far between. However, in a city like Albuquerque, First Nations Clinic has a number of competitors just blocks from its location.
You know, we don't know what it's really going to look like, but we do know that that is always a possibility that, yes, there is going to be competition.
Not only competition, but perhaps even less funding for the IHS. Jim Roberts is a Native American health expert with the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board.
There could be a mindset that would evolve in Congress that why should we continue to fund the Indian health system when you have access to Medicaid and you have access to the insurance exchange market? You should go there to receive your care.
Still, Roberts estimates that nationally, the Medicaid population in the IHS system could double next year. That's because many members, like John Armijo of Jemez Pueblo, will likely continue bringing their medical needs to their local servers.
I'd rather come here first and then go outside. This is my hometown, the reservation I live on. I'm a tribal member, and I'd like to help the health center here first.
And with Armijo's Medicaid dollars flowing to IHS, Better programs, new hires, and expanded services may be on the horizon. In Albuquerque, I'm Tristan Ottown.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. We hear about a program to try to get more young Latinas to college.
A lot of them don't know what their options are. They don't know that they could go to a community college rather than a university. They don't know where to get scholarships.
Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. More than 25% of the farm labor force in the U.S. is believed to be working without legitimate documents. The Senate's immigration reform proposal offers a fast track to citizenship for agricultural workers so that they can, quote, continue to do the vital work of growing and harvesting food. Fronteras sent reporter Laurel Morales to look at the dairy industry in Wisconsin, where at least half the workers are undocumented.
The smell is the first thing you notice on a dairy farm. John Rosno's farm sits just a couple bluffs away from the Mississippi River in western Wisconsin. Two spacious barns house the cows. Outside, the calves rest in long rows of individual huts. The snow is finally melting after a long, wet winter. Everyone is smiling on the warmest day so far this year. Rosno tells a neighbor, this is the beginning of being nice.
Sunshine instead of snow.
Inside a large white building, 18 cows file into the milking parlor where Marco, a young worker from Mexico, cleans udders, hooks up the milking machines, and shovels manure.
We sell about a semi-load of milk a day, every day.
So. Rosno and his workers currently milk 550 cows around the clock. Not that long ago, most dairy farms were small, family-operated. But in the mid-90s, dairymen like Rosno realized shrinking profit margins meant they had to get big or get out. But Rosno says it was difficult to find workers.
I'd put ads in the paper or I'd try to recruit people locally, and I just could not get anybody to apply, let alone have quality people apply.
When he heard about a company that connected workers from Mexico with farmers in the U.S., he called them up.
Over the last 10 years, I've probably had 150 people apply for jobs here. Two of them were Americans. They had a whole bunch of stipulations on when they could work and how they would work and what they would do. People say, well, why don't you just pay more? Well, we do pay more than minimum wage by a long shot.
Rosno pays between $27,000 and $40,000 a year, along with health benefits and housing. Most farmers don't provide health insurance. He currently has 8 employees from Mexico. As to their legal status,
I've been advised by my lawyer, if I look at those documents and as a reasonable person, I look at the documents and they look like they're real, I am to accept them.
Rosno pulls out his federal employment forms, or I-9s. He says new employees from Mexico, who arrive usually after a brutal walk across the border and long bus ride, show him a Social Security card and a green card. This is what he'd show federal officials if he were ever investigated. But it's never happened. Rosno is aware of only 2 farmers in the Midwest who have ever been audited by federal authorities. Still, this reality leaves Rosno vulnerable.
My livelihood totally and completely depends on these people doing all this work. My retirement, everything, would pretty much go out the window.
So for several years, Rosno has gone to Washington to lobby lawmakers for immigration reform that would include a way for people to get what he calls valid Social Security numbers so they could get driver's licenses and passports. He says the current reform debate is the closest they've come, so he's optimistic.
Their lives will improve dramatically, and so will ours.
Brad Barham teaches agricultural economics at the University of Wisconsin. He says Rosno's reliance on this labor force is a norm throughout the industry.
Immigrant labor plays a critical role in the Wisconsin dairy industry and an even larger one across the U.S., especially in the western states. So they're crucial to all aspects of our lives in terms of the way in which this economy works.
That's why lawmakers have pushed for an expedited path to citizenship for farm workers in the latest immigration reform proposal in Washington. Under the Senate bill, workers could obtain legal residency after 5 years. But Alejandro is skeptical. He works at a Wisconsin dairy farm and didn't want to use his last name. He says politicians say a lot of things and they don't do anything. More than anything, I want them to stop talking and do something for us. Alejandro says he doesn't want to stay in the U.S. forever. Instead, he would like to travel back home freely. He has a 2-year-old daughter in Mexico, whom he has never met. I'm Laura Morales, reporting in Cochrane, Wisconsin.
The Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund found in 2009 that 41% of Hispanic females across the nation do not graduate with their high school class in 4 years, if they graduate at all. The nonprofit group Latinitas empowers young Latinas through media and technology. The organization's holding some events they're calling College Chica in Texas and New Mexico to try to demystify the challenges of getting into and going to college. I spoke with Samantha Lopez, program coordinator at Latinitas.
So Latinitas started as a project at a UT class, and it's the first digital magazine for and by Latina girls. And so we have them working with digital media like photography, filmmaking, journalism. We do a lot of writing and blogging. And we do that all in our after-school programs, our summer camps, our Saturday camps, and we are partnering with a bunch of different organizations and schools around the nation. That way we're not just limited to Austin and El Paso. We've got two offices. And so we're just really excited about being able to work here in San Antonio and get to as many young girls as we can and get them thinking about college and also what their opportunities are in working with in digital media and technology by utilizing all of our resources. Well, what we've found is, in general, just getting to college, you know, after high school, a lot of them don't know what their options are. They don't know that they could go to a community college rather than a university. They don't know where to get scholarships, how to deal with housing. And more often than not, we're hearing stories, more and more stories about their families not wanting them to go off to college. You know, they're so tight-knit. They want them to stay in town, or they want them to, you know, contribute to the family, which is understandable. But that's their first priority, is, you know, kind of maintaining that family.
How do you reach those people when it's sort of a family, kind of trying to keep everyone still tight-knit and maybe not sending someone to another city or state?
Well, what we really try and do is see what they would ideally like to do. Of course, if they want to stay in town, you know, kind of showing them their resources there. But even going nationally and learning about how to create that family culture at your campus. So finding organizations that you fit in with, whether it's joining a sorority or another kind of cultural group, extracurricular activities, things like that, where they get that kind of same family feeling.
With the economy, I mean, that must be a big roadblock right now. There are even some people saying, is college the right way to go right now? Because people with degrees can't even get jobs. How is that factoring into this?
Well, what we feel is that, you know, showing them what their options are is so much better than just allowing them to kind of find it on their own. You know, maybe some of them don't want to go to college or only see college as being something they want to do, you know, for the first couple of years, maybe get an associate's, and that's totally fine. You know, looking at the landscape, that's totally understandable. But what we want them to do is to start critically thinking about those things, what jobs to look for, what majors they have to go through to get those jobs.
You know, you're starting out with middle school girls and trying to get this message to them that early.
Actually started to do some things with elementary school girls in Austin. There's kind of an initiative in the after school program starting to get them thinking about it. And they've also started to name schools like College Prep Academy and things like that. And, you know, we really just feel that introducing them from as early as elementary school is effective in that they're thinking about it not as some mysterious place that they might end up, but more as something that is attainable, and for them to have more time to really ask questions and meet more people, even in college, you know, professors, students. And that's really, I feel, is what the unique part of our programs are, is that we bring them these college women in our after school program as their mentors. We have an after school club on elementary and middle school campuses where we have leaders, club leaders that are in college. And so the girls really look up to them and they feel like they can connect to them and see themselves in those women. And so to really have those girls show them what it's like to go to college and what it means to them is something very valuable to the girls.
What may factor into it taking longer than 4 years for a Latina to attain a degree?
Well, I think one of the first things is probably the financial situation. You know, there are tons of scholarships out there, but so many of them don't know how to get to that point. And when we start to look at, you know, applications and college essays, they're a lot of times the just kind of in general, the writing isn't where it needs to be, or their volunteer experience isn't where it needs to be. So what we love to do is like a huge part of our program is journalism and having them blog through mylatinitas.com and having them really reflect on what's going on in their community. That way they're getting kind of a critical thinking aspect early on. And then they start to think about, you know, where can I get my resources and become kind of self-efficient.
And so this is College Chica's first year, you're saying, right?
Yes, this is the first time we're theming it College Chica here in San Antonio. This is our third annual workshop we have. We've been partnering with the University of Incarnate Word for the past 3 years, and they've been great. They've opened their doors, and we're able to do all of our workshops in the communications department, where they have a green screen studio, they have a radio studio. So we get the girls working with digital media hands-on while incorporating the college theme and interviewing students.
That was Samantha Lopez, Program Coordinator of Latinitas. You can find more information about the group, their digital magazine, and the College Chica events at latinitasmagazine.org. There will be workshops in San Antonio at University of the Incarnate Word this Saturday. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Fronteras Desk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.